Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Decouple Podcast, where we explore the science and technologies that can decouple human well-being from its ecological impacts, and the politics that can make decoupling possible. Welcome back to Decouple. Today I'm joined by Chief Science Advisor for the podcast, Sean Wagner. Sean is the director of the Alberta Nuclear Nucleus and a great friend of mine. Sean, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, sir. It's good to be here.
So Sean, I've brought you on today to deal with a very technical topic, that of carbon capture and storage. Seems to be loved and hated in the broader discourse around climate. Certainly my fairly uneducated perspective is that the fossil fuel industry is really seeing this as a way forward to try and maintain its supremacy. And that's probably why a lot of folks on the other side of the spectrum really dislike carbon capture and storage. I think we're going to aim for a bit more of a nuanced take on this. The last place that really crossed my radar was looking at some of China's ambitious climate plans. And they had a big chunk, which was, in terms of their accounting, which was bioenergy with carbon capture and storage. That seemed to be one of their big tools for, you know, achieving the famed net zero by, I think it's 2060 in the Tsinghua study. So it's been on my radar for a little while. I'm looking forward to understanding the science a bit more with you, and who better to speak with. So Sean, again, welcome, a warm welcome to Decouple.
Oh, excellent. All right. If we're talking about science, then I hope most people don't get flashbacks to like Vietnam when I start talking about grade 10 and 12 science.
Yeah, I'll be honest. That was me before I went back to high school and early university when I decided I want to do medicine, because I'd decided that math was hard and therefore ignored physics and chemistry. So, but Sean, before you get into that, just give us a quick little humanize yourself introduction. Who are you? What are you all about?
Sure. My name is Sean Wagner. I originally started out as an engineer. I have a master's degree in engineering from the University of Alberta. My field is in materials science. And after I got into materials engineering, and after I worked for a little while doing some research at the university myself, I ended up starting up Alberta Nuclear Nucleus because I'm kind of been a proponent of nuclear energy, but no one was really doing it visibly here out in the west of Canada. So I was just like, well, if no one's doing it, then I might as well. And so that was almost 2.5 years ago that I started ANN up. And since then, I've made a bunch of friends across the industry and across the globe. And I met you, and we kind of worked together to start up Canadians for Nuclear. And we're still trucking along and seeing how things go.
All right. And the rest is history. So Sean, let's dive into the materials at hand here. So carbon capture and storage, I think we're going to start talking about, where we can actually start grabbing the stuff from. We were starting at what, pre-industrial CO2 levels,
250, 260 PPM at around
our daily count today. What are we, 417 today, I think, or?
Yeah, I don't know. I try and avoid looking at the Keeling curve. It just makes me depressed.
All right. So anyway, a lot of little molecules up there. I found this was interesting. Rediscovering a love of basic science, that the atoms and molecules in our atmosphere, if they're the same, like if it's N2, for instance, it doesn't trap the infrared that's bouncing off the planet. But if it's a molecule made up of unlike atoms, then they vibrate and they trap the heat. I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah. Well, technically N2 does trap energy. All molecules, when they are even single atoms or molecules together, will trap some sort of energy. And you can actually see this in what are called their infrared spectrum or their Raman spectrum. And you can search that up and you'll get this weird, like spiky graph for any molecule that you have. And that shows you what wavelengths those molecules will trap. Now, the thing that makes CO2 kind of annoying for us is that it has a big peak, a big wide peak, that it traps a lot of heat. So a lot of infrared and mid-infrared energy in its rotation and its vibrational frequencies that it has. And so it's just right in that perfect Goldilocks zone of, these are this is where heat is. It's not, mm-hmm. you know, it's not red light. It's not blue light. It's not microwaves or anything like that. It's just, it's heat. And it's that really annoying kind of perfect wavelength for it.
And it's really long lived within the atmosphere. Like methane, yeah. I think has a, I forget the half-life, but it's in the tens or hundreds of years, but CO2 just hangs around for a long time.
It's close to 30,000 years, if I remember correctly.
Yeah. And I mean, yeah, just, you know, get as an introduction, I need to sort of get another climate scientist on here to sort of talk through sort of geologic time and how CO2 levels have, correlated and I guess been a causative agent of climate change. One of the more, like, I'm really into history as well, and one of the more interesting historical anecdotes, and I'm not sure if this has been proven, but one of the theories as to the origin of the Little Ice Age throughout I believe it was like 1200 up until 1700,
up until about, yeah, late 1600s, early 1700s.
So I mean, what was really cool about this and my read of it was that seemed to have been started off probably by the Black Death, killing off, I think it was 100 million people.
Yeah, it was a good third of Europe at the time.
Yeah, and I mean, you think about when we were using biomass as energy and cutting down all our forests and farming every scrap of land to feed everybody. When everybody dies off, that grew back and sunk a lot of carbon. So infectious disease is a driver of climate change. It's so cool. But then obviously with the discovery of the Americas and introduction of novel diseases to that population, you know, the pre-contact population estimated something around maybe 100 million and 99% of that dying off in the course of probably less than a century. And again, the grow back of that highly managed landscape we think about, especially North Americans, I think there's a tendency to think about, you know, the noble savage and untouched wilderness, but of course a highly managed landscape and lots of tree growth that grew back and pulled carbon down. So interesting that those kind of pre-industrial fluctuations had such an impact on climate. And you can only imagine what.
Well, it's not just those two. The other one that you're missing out on is the Mongol expansion in the Khanate empires, because that's happening at about the same time as the Black Death in Europe.
Okay, yeah.
So you've got these massive, you know, removals of urban areas. Let's just, you know, say that politely.
They burned them down though. So wouldn't, I mean, did they blade waste and burn the cities?
Yes, but they also ended up with a lot of tree growth in those suddenly unused areas.
Okay.
So yeah, you have the Black Death, you have the Mongol empire expansion, you have the reforestation of North America after the introduction of settlers. Like there's a set of things that definitely did form a lot out of biomass regrowth in those, you know, centuries.
I think it's interesting because like a lot of the sort of climate denialists will be like, it's all solar cycles and we're just some little humans, how could we be impacting the climate? And it's like, well, even before we were burning fossil fuels, it looks like there was impact. So
oh yeah, it is a thing. That's the thing. It's the whole thing is like it's a teeter-totter basically. If you remove a little bit from one side, the whole thing shifts a little bit and then it shifts back and shifts, but it doesn't take much to really kind of move the whole thing. Like you think mm-hmm. about the entire mass of the atmosphere and it's, you know, hundreds of trillions of tons of oxygen and nitrogen and carbon dioxide and stuff like that, if not quadrillions of tons. So and you think oh, there's no way, but you know, you put in, you know, 40 billion tons of CO2 a year by, you know, throwing in some tens of billions of tons of carbon and remove and pulling tens of billions of tons of oxygen out and sticking it onto that carbon. That's another thing that another thing that people don't really realize is that as CO2 goes up, our oxygen concentration goes down.
Is that measurable? I mean, like, you know,
it is actually
in medicine, like, you know, our room air oxygen, like before you put someone on oxygen, is a, you know, a fraction of inspired oxygen is 21%. And that doesn't change with altitude. It's just that the relative, you know, pressures change and everything. But is that, I mean, I guess you have very, very, sensitive scientific tools beyond my little oxygen meter probe or my blood gas measures.
Yeah. Like we're talking about, you know, parts per million, because one O2 goes to one CO2.
Right. So,
but that means that it's one for one. As CO2 increases in the atmosphere, oxygen has to decrease.
Okay. So, and again, we are going to get to the carbon capture and storage, but another interesting features that obviously oxygen levels have changed throughout geologic history. And there's, yeah, I'd love you to and give me a little more insight on this, because a couple things. One, someone was telling me that like when there were dragonflies that were 2 meters long, that was because and only allowed by oxygen levels, you know, being something like 30 or even 40%.
Yeah.
But then I read something James Lovelock was saying, you know, at that time, the whole atmosphere was kind of at risk of catching on fire because of, is that accurate? I respect James Lovelock a lot. It sounded a little far out. Maybe I'm misreading him, but.
You wouldn't catch the atmosphere on fire. The thing you need to catch something on fire is you need a fuel and you need an oxidizer.
Gotcha.
So you need something for the oxygen to react with. And nitrogen is very famous of not giving a shit until you make it really, really hot and really, really high pressures.
Okay.
That's why we have, you know, catalytic converters on our cars so that we don't, you know, spew a bunch of nitrous oxides out into the atmosphere.
Right.
But yeah, like when you have 35, 40% oxygen in your atmosphere, you get massive wildfires.
Right. So I'm just thinking about like, you know, I've spent a lot of time around campfires in my day. I'm a bit of a reformed mountain man. Anyway, that's another story. But you know, like when the wind blows on a fire, it, you know, it kicks it up and everything. But a wind blowing a 40% oxygen atmosphere onto a fire would be impressive.
It would be. It's very, very large, very, very hot.
Wow. It's, okay.
Oxygen speeds things up. It's an accelerant for a lot of chemical reactions.
Right.
Things. The more oxygen you have, the faster things go. That's why a lot of people, you know, feel. That's why you give people oxygen when they are like having problems breathing. You need to get more fuel into them. Oxygen drives a lot of the reactions in our chemical system.
And of course, it also drives a lot of chaos and free radical formation, which our bodies are very well adapted to. But this was another really interesting, just because we're having a bit of a science geek episode here, which I love. Sheila Wittock, a friend of ours, a great podcast called Willing to Listen. She's an advocate for learning more, an open process for the Deep Geologic Repository here in Canada. But she had Douglas Borham on. Who's a very respected doctor and scientist who studies radiation quite a bit. And something he said that I found to be really fascinating was he was talking about, you know, the mechanism for ionizing radiation causing damage to DNA. And obviously one of those, and it's a very minor portion of it, is those high energy photons actually crashing into a piece of DNA.
Yeah.
But the much more common one is the creation of free radicals through ionization of water within the cell. And what he said was that I found was so fascinating was he was like, because as a doctor, I used to spend a lot more time, still, you know, because of my training, spend a bit of time agonizing about this, you know, we say pulling the trigger. Am I going to order this test? Am I going to expose this patient to the equivalent of like 4 years of background radiation in a flash in a few seconds? But what he was saying is that if you have a patient that is, you know, got low oxygen and you're blasting oxygen up their nose, medical oxygen, the amount of free radical damage, the amount of ionization that you're causing by being on oxygen for an hour while you're in the waiting room for that CT scan is going to be far more damage than the CT itself would cause, which I thought was super fascinating. We've actually, you know, the medical literature is actually really starting to shift on this. We used to say give them 100% oxygen, but we've actually seen like people die with much more frequency, like that we call the number needed to harm is quite low when you get people's oxygen levels insanely high, right? Because we can measure it with a pulse oximeter and you get 100%, but you're not actually seeing the pressure of the oxygen within the actual bloodstream, which can be
the excess. Yeah.
Yeah. There's, which can be enormous and just induce all this free radical damage. So that's another kind of,
That's a thing. Oxygen is basically gaseous acid. It's a thing that we just accept because, you know, we need it to live. But like chemically, oxygen is like terrifying stuff. It eats everything.
Right. Yeah. It rusts things.
It rusts everything. There's a lovely little thing online that I see pop up every once in a while. It's like, you need oxygen to cause a fire. Does that mean that old age is just people really slowly burning to death?
Right. Yeah. Or the compost heap, right? As well.
Yeah, it's a thing. But yeah, but we're not here to talk about oxygen. We're here to talk about carbon dioxide.
Sure. But we've done the tour of the major components of the atmosphere, nitrogen, oxygen, a little bit of carbon that's building up.
And now we're getting
Okay, so we've put way too much up there. It's influencing the climate. Obviously, the lowest hanging fruit is to stop putting so much up there, which is, I think, why we are both strong advocates for nuclear energy.
Yep.
But the stuff that's up there, how are we gonna deal with that?
All right. Well,
mechanically, I guess, because you're an engineer, we're gonna mechanically. Yeah.
Unfortunately,
some people think we just plant the world just with hemp for us, and it's all gonna be good, right? But we won't laugh at them right now. Let's just focus on mechanically how we're gonna get it out of the atmosphere. What are the tools at hand? What's the science behind them, and how realistic are they?
All right. Fundamentally, all chemistry, for no matter what you're doing, breaks down to surface area of interaction. Gotcha. The more surface area you have, the more reactions you can do at one time, and the faster you can do anything, and the more materials you can work with. So if you want to pull carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, you need to make as much surface area as possible to touch as much of that carbon dioxide as possible at any one time, so you can actually pull it out of the atmosphere. Now, there's three major ways you can do that. You can do that at the stack, which is actually a quite efficient way of preventing CO2 from getting out. So you actually physically block the carbon dioxide from getting out of whatever facility is making it. And this helps. This is pretty good because A, it's already really concentrated, so your reaction kinetics and thermodynamics are very favorable. It's very easy to pull. It's very easy to keep something that is already at a high concentration.
Do you have an idea like the parts per million in the flue gas versus in the atmosphere?
You're talking like in the flue gas, you're talking like hundreds of thousands part per million. You're talking
like two thirds of it is carbon dioxide, or 50%.
Okay. If you're talking like a perfect burn in like a high temperature natural gas plant, yeah, you're talking almost 50%. The rest is water.
Okay. Versus my math is obscenely bad, but in the atmosphere, like less than 1%?
Yeah. 0.4%.
0.4%. Okay. That seems like 0.4 is still a lot. Damn. Okay.
0.4 is a lot.
Yeah. I mean, I'm always trying to like deal with issues of like numeracy and really large numbers and trying to like do that science communication. Do you have any tools for trying to like help people visualize that? Or?
Well, for us nuclear people, 0.4% is slightly more than half of the amount of fissile uranium-235 in natural uranium ore.
All right. We'll think of some other 0.4%.
Well, in my high school had 2,000 people in it. Mm-hmm. So 0.4% would be 80 people.
Okay. Wow. It's kind of more than I had been thinking about before I started looking at it.
No, wait. 80 people? No, it would be 8 people.
8 people, yeah.
8. Okay. 8 gotcha. People out of 2,000.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I mean, it'd be kind of fun to like dress a few people up in various colored t-shirts or something to illustrate that. But yeah.
And, you know,
those 8 people are real bullies. But so tell me a little bit more about, we're capturing it at the stack. What, I don't think we need to like deep dive the actual technologies and the kind of like molecules involved, but just more subjectively, this is the easiest place to do it because that's the highest concentration.
Yeah, easiest place to do it because it's the highest concentration and it actually has the most energy. So chemical reactions basically all chemical reactions require energy to happen. So if you can start with those things having energy already, then you don't need to add more energy to do it, or at least you don't need to add as much energy to do it if it's a energetically unfavorable reaction.
Gotcha.
So for things like that, is like it's the first step in preventing things. So you'd want to do that over all your fossil fuel plants, all your chemical upgraders and crackers, all of your cement plants. You do that and you cut like a good 50% of CO2 emissions.
Okay, so for dummies though, like what does this look like on the stack? Are you putting it like an absorber material? I hear that these things are like, they require a lot of energy. And so, you know, on a coal plant, if you put this carbon capture technology on it, about 30% more power to just power the CO2 extraction method. And then there's that paradox with a fossil plant. Well, then we need to mine 30% more coal and burn 30% more coal.
Yeah, does
this make sense? Like, does the math of it make sense? Like, is it all a mirage?
The thing is that pulling CO2 out of the atmosphere by using energy created from making more CO2 doesn't.
Because right.
that would be a violation of like the law of conservation of energy.
Gotcha.
You can't get more energy out of something like that. And the thing is that all of, you know how a power plant has like an efficiency, it's like 40% yeah. efficient in yeah, making electricity. Yeah. That means that that last 60%, most of that is going out of the flue stack in that CO2 that you're getting. So you have to somehow prevent all of that energy from getting out. So you have to capture it, you have to right. cool it, and you have to condense it, and then you have to move it.
Do you have any idea how, like, you know, like, because we have scrubbers on coal plants, for instance, that take out sulfur and particulates and stuff, and that has,
yeah.
I know it's financially costly, and that's why the coal industry really was trying to refuse to do that until things like the Clean Air Act came along. But energetically, do you know what the costs, like, you know, again, I've heard this figure, like 30% of the overall energy from the plant is needed to actually do carbon capture and storage, but
it doesn't quite scan one-to-one for sulfur dioxides and nitrous oxides to CO2.
It's much easier, I guess, right?
It is a lot easier to get the sulfur and the nitrous oxides out.
Do you have any idea how much easier? Is it like 10 times easier? I'm putting you on the spot here, but
I can't give you a real accurate number, but I would say it would be like, best guess scenario for me, it's at least twice as easy mm-hmm. to get them out because they are significantly more chemically reactive than CO2. CO2 is a major pain in the ass because it is so inert.
Right.
It is gotcha. A massive pain in the ass. It does not want to interact with anything. It's very low energy. It's very, very stable. So
in our high school, I don't know, it's kind of like the introvert loners that somehow are still yeah, raising the temperature of the whole high school.
Yeah, it's the people that no one talks to, but everyone knows.
Right, gotcha. Okay, so, and again, just in terms of visualizing this, like, does the stack look different? Is it way bigger? Like, where are you putting this thing?
No, not really. It's what you tend to do is you actually tend to put the scrubbers at the bottom of the stack because way everything goes into the scrubber at right. its most reactive, at its highest pressure, at gotcha. Its highest temperature. And that way, then you can separate things at the scrubber itself and pull off your feedstocks and your materials. And then you just let your water vapor go out the top.
Cool. So in terms of like an actually existing plant, I understand there have been some pilot projects. I was reading about one, I'm not sure, I think it might've been in Texas, a coal plant where they were capturing carbon. I think they had to run a whole separate turbine just to power the scrubber to get that carbon out. So we were talking about that, that paradox there and the laws of conservation of energy. But then ironically, they were taking the sequestered carbon, I think they're compressing it as a gas and pushing it into a neighboring oil field to increase extraction of more hydrocarbons from the oil.
I mean, technically at that point, the best you're saying is that you're now carbon neutral because you're not preventing anything from coming out, but you're, you know, sequestering the stuff that is coming out, but you're using it to make more, which, you know,
kind but in of this plant it wasn't even achieving that. Like, that's kind of best case scenario. No. Is if you could capture all the carbon that you were burning and somehow deliver it back.
Yeah, if you can do it with perfect efficiency, then you could theoretically get to like carbon neutrality.
So, but, I mean, we're going to talk about other forms of capture, but I think just because we've got this nice visualization of this power plant that's, you know, sequestering it, there's a whole challenge of you got to put it back. You're generating a whole bunch on site. And I guess this existing facility, I should have the name on file. I don't have it at the tip of my fingers, but they had to, I guess, have a pipeline network to ship this compressed gas and then have a rock formation nearby to squeeze it down into that's hopefully gets to an impermeable layer that will retain it. Cause I gather like once you've injected it, it's not like stored nuclear fuel, which is not going to go anywhere. It's a gas.
It's a lot more mobile. It'll try and move through as many places as it can, but from what I know of, injection into geological formations of CO2, what you want to get them into is a reactive formation like a limestone or a calcium carbonate or a salt formation, something like that. Places where, you know, oil tends to form because a lot of those formations are actually built by decay of previous organic materials.
Right.
So that works because if you can get it into a chemically reactive formation, then it'll tend to bond with whatever surface area is available and become even more stable. which is the entire goal, because you want to isolate it from the actual ecosphere for as long as possible.
But suffice it to say, like, you know, if we were to try and scale up carbon capture and storage and make it a major part of our decarbonization strategy, it sounds like you need to build a new parallel network of pipelines, of maybe, like, I don't know, even like huge compressed gas tankers to ship this stuff to the appropriate geologic site, reinject it into the ground. Like, this isn't something where, I mean, I think a lot of the hype around hydrogen is like, hey, we can use existing distribution networks, or, you know, even with synth fuels, for instance. But yeah, in terms of carbon capture and storage, this would require the building of significant new infrastructure to, you know, I get, because in nuclear, I think we talk about like the, what is it, like the front of the fuel cycle and the back of the fuel cycle, because we're trying to make like a closed cycle. But with fossil fuels, we just dump it into the community dumping ground of the atmosphere. You'd have to build that whole back end of the fuel cycle on if you were to,
you would exactly have to build an entirely new infrastructure for it, because that is exactly what you're doing. You're closing that fuel cycle.
Right.
And everything that comes out of a place has to go back into it. And yeah, it is a massive, massive investment if you're planning on doing that. And that's why, honestly, I think storing CO2 as a gas or as a liquid is not really a viable solution, because the mm-hmm. volumes and the reactivities and the mobility of the material that you're trying to store is just too high. It's too high to be practical. So the things that you really want to do with CO2 is you want to solidify it and remove its ability to be mobile. So you want to stop it from being CO2, because CO2 as a solid sublimates and it turns back into a gas and it becomes mobile again.
Okay. And so that's dry ice, right?
Yeah, dry ice.
Okay.
That is exactly what it is. So the things that you want to do is you want to take the carbon out of the CO2 and you want to bind it into some other long-lived molecule. There's two major contenders for the best ways of storing carbon for long terms.
Yeah.
That says solid carbon or coal, and and as cellulose.
Okay.
Or wood.
Okay. Interesting.
Those are basically the only two options that we have.
Where it'll be stable and it's not going to sublimate.
Exactly.
That's nuts. Okay.
I mean, technically you could make plastic if you just made like hundreds of millions of tons of polyethylene, put it in a big block and then buried it underground.
Can you make useful stuff with it? I mean, could that be?
Oh, yeah.
I was talking with James Flea, who's a good friend of mine from Australia and been on the podcast a couple of times. And he's a political conservative, and he talks about, you know, true conservatism is about conserving, you know, all of the resources that we have so that future generations are not robbed by our activities. And so one of his big arguments for, you know, he's worked as a power engineer in the fossil fuel industry, but one of the big things he says is we need to save this stuff because it's a really useful feedstock for everything we use around us, including your like Lululemon yoga pants. So, I mean, are we going to be sequestering, carbon into some Lululemons in the future?
Yeah, well, he's 100% right. Carbon is an amazing feedstock for all sorts of things. We use it for plastics. We use it for fertilizers. We use it for medicines. We use it for like everything. Like everything in front of you, in your room, like your microphone is a polymer product.
Yeah.
The capacitors in your computer probably have carbon in them because it's a good conductor for capacitor surfaces. Like, carbon is an amazing feedstock. And yeah, if you want to spend the energy to get your carbon sources from the CO2 that's out there, you can totally do it. It's just very energy intensive, which is, it's actually more energy intensive than just mining new carbon.
Yeah,
because that comes back to the same reason that, you know, catching carbon at the stack is the most efficient method that we have right now, because it's concentrated in the formations that we mine it from.
Gotcha.
When we're the less concentrated that you have a source of, the more energy you need to get anything out of it. It's basically the 80. You can kind of approximate it as the 80-20 rule.
Right.
It'll take approximately the same amount of energy to get the first 80% of any source out as it will to get the last 20% out.
Right. Okay.
And so the less concentrated you get, the more that energy cost goes up.
All right, so that flows very nicely into, I think, your second area where we can capture carbon, and that's just direct air. So tell me a little bit about that, the challenges. I understand there's also pilot projects there. I've seen some really nice YouTube videos of this company that's setting up. They say it's all existing technology, these huge fans. I'm not sure, again, the engineering behind it, but they're generating, I think, a synth fuel out of it, like a kind of guilt-free,
that's that's either Climeworks, which I do believe is based in Switzerland or Austria or somewhere in the EU, or Carbon Engineering, which is based in British Columbia, Canada.
Okay.
There's several other like fairly large groups that are working on direct air carbon capture. And
so before we get into like, I guess, some of the science and the limitations and everything to that, like a big part of, like, I've done several podcasts now on hydrogen, on nuclear fusion, and, you know, on those topics that seem to be like, hey, this is cool. I mean, with fusion, it's just like, it's really cool. Maybe there's some applications far in the future, but the engineering considerations are absolutely insane. And it's not at all a practical near, medium, or maybe even far term tool for running our energy systems on. With hydrogen, it was like, yeah, absolutely. This is an essential thing that we need to be able to make. And we've got a ton of it being made for fertilizer right now that we need to decarbonize. Is it like it's something we can do, but it's not going to become the panacea for firming intermittent power sources or a significant source for, you know, grid generation. Mm-hmm. So I think the real question and the reason I brought you on was I'm trying to understand carbon capture and storage. It's fascinating that we can do it. But what I'm really interested in is, you know, is it scalable? Is it something we're going to be able to do on a large scale? So let's dive into that direct air carbon and capture. Because I mean, and this is the reason I'm also interested in this is, you know, I've had folks like Brett Kugelmass on the podcast, who, you know, I think, has a very interesting take on how we can make nuclear sort of four times cheaper than coal. It's very controversial, his take on things that flies in the face of all conventional wisdom on nuclear.
Brett is a very optimistic man. And I love that about him.
Like if I had to, you know, if I ruled the world and people came to me with a number of, suggestions on how to arrest climate change, I think I would probably take Brett's. Like, you know, in a world where there wasn't all these other considerations and regulatory agencies in effect. But a big part of what his sort of the Brett plan relies on is direct air carbon capture powered by nuclear. Because I guess when we're talking about, you know, these laws of thermodynamics, it's not very concentrated. We've gone from you know, the stack where it's 40-50% of the flue gas to now being what we were saying before, 0.4% or something, right?
Yeah, it's a big jump. So the thing with direct air carbon capture is that it obeys the same laws that we were talking about with the flue gas, is that it's the chemistry is about surface area. The more surface area you have, the faster you can make a reaction happen and the more you can work with. And so one of the benefits of direct air carbon capture is that you don't run the potential of overloading any of your reaction sites, because there's just not enough CO2 in the air itself. So basically, no matter how much air you move through and how much you compress it, you're not going to overload any of your reaction sites. So you're not going to, you know, have massive amounts of overflow and require massive loops coming through to make sure that you've got every last thing. Because the thing is that we're not trying to remove all of the carbon dioxide. We need carbon dioxide to live. It's just a fundamental aspect of chemistry and how the balance of our reactions happen in our bodies and in trees and in everything like that. What we need to do is we need to control the amount of CO2 in the air. We need to get it down to, like, I've heard around 300 to 310 PPM would really be like ideal.
The sweet Holocene spot for
it's the salt bay of you know, how much CO2 we need in the atmosphere. We just need 310.
Okay, gotcha.
So what you need to work with there is just like direct air carbon capture is just going to take an absolute ass load of infrastructure. Right. None of it is unproven, really. At this point, everything can be done. Right now, people are just really, really working on getting their efficiencies up and trying to get their costs down, because without an actual price on carbon, it's not viable, because no one's paying for that CO2.
Right.
Because we can just make more CO2 when we need it for things like dry ice or chilling or chemical reactions. Like CO2 is cheap. Mm-hmm. So without a price on it, pulling it from the atmosphere is not going to be economically viable, period. End of story, full stop.
And so, I mean, you know, when I was talking to Brett, we didn't actually touch too much on this side of things, but I've looked at some of his other work. And he talks about like, it's going to require an absolutely enormous amount of energy, and where are we going to get that energy from? And it needs to be from an ultra low carbon source to make it all make sense. But what about just, you're saying the infrastructure, like in terms of the size of the machines, the number of the machines that would need to be built, like that sounds like it's mind boggling, right?
It is, well, you can kind of approximate how big it would need to be by thinking about it in terms of energy. Remember how I said earlier that, you know, a power plant has, you know, a certain efficiency of electricity generation, and that all of the stuff that isn't used for electricity, most of that energy is going out the stack into the gases. Mm-hmm. And so you've got 60% of a 1 gigawatt plant is going literally up the stack, right? And half of that is CO2. So 30% of that entire 1 gigawatt plant is energy that's in that CO2. By conservation of energy, you can basically assume that you need to spend at least that amount of energy to get all that CO2 back out of the atmosphere. So the infrastructure that you need to build to get that CO2 out has to be able to handle 30% of the entire energy grid of the entire planet that uses CO2, that uses fossil fuels. That's the scale of the infrastructure that we need to do to get that stuff.
And so that's just the scale of the power infrastructure to power it, or that's the scale of the machines that are required to, like the big fans and
That is the scale of the machines.
Wow.
So like to really kind of get direct air carbon capture on a scale that we can use it to actually manage our atmosphere on an active basis, yeah, you're talking easily a doubling of total electrical generation of the planet.
Okay. Wow. You know, I think with a lot of technology, we live in a time when there's an enormous sort of like suspicion and pessimism about technology, and an overzealous application of the precautionary principle is, I guess, how I would put it in terms of vaccines, in terms of agriculture and biotechnology. But at the same time, there's this parallel over optimism in technology as well, which I think is very much built off of, you know, the successes of Silicon Valley and Moore's Law. And we've dealt with that in previous episodes on the podcast. But you know, is this an issue? And actually a very interesting podcast with Mark P. Mills, where we really, you know, he's an engineer and a physicist. And really, you know, what I found to be very interesting about that talk with him was talking about, you know, the ways in which there's big differences between tech and, you know, superconductor chips and power plants, and the way that the laws of physics apply differently. But is this a similar situation where, is, you know, there's not going to be some kind of Moore's Law type breakthrough that's going to make carbon capture and storage so much more efficient because of just the laws of conservation of energy and the thermodynamic laws?
Yeah, I can't see a real kind of quantum mechanics breakthrough style change in how we capture carbon, because it's such a large scale process that there's just sometimes the best quality is quantity.
Yeah.
And sometimes you just have to accept that. And it's sad to realize that, yeah, there's not going to be a secret sneaky 11th hour run around to, you know, for the hero to sneak past the guards and hit the big red button and save the world. But sometimes you just need to build a bunch of stuff. Now, however, there is another way of doing carbon capture. And in my opinion, it's the smarter way to do it, because it doesn't just capture carbon. It also helps out with another major problem, which is ocean acidification, which is brought on by these higher CO2 concentrations.
And so like, I'm blanking on the number, but something like 90% of the excess energy created from anthropogenic climate change so far has been absorbed by the oceans. And I forget what amount of the actual CO2 we've put into the atmosphere. I mean, there'd be a lot more in the atmosphere if the ocean hadn't sucked up. What percentage of it? Do you have a sense of that?
I cannot tell you off the top of my head. It's a lot. Mucho? It's a lot. Well, think about it. The ocean is surface area. It's a chemical reaction surface area, and it covers 70% of our planet.
Right.
That's a big amount of space.
It's and it's churning around and it's circular
constantly
for now anyway, moving. Right?
And it's constantly moving, which means it's constantly pulling CO2 out of the air and into it, because there's a neat thing about water that, unlike a lot of things, have you ever made like super, super thick iced tea where you take hot water and your iced tea crystals and you just keep dumping iced tea into it until you can mix it up? It basically syrup. That's a common thing with water. Things tend to get more soluble the hotter the water is.
Okay.
CO2 gets more soluble the colder water is until it freezes.
Oh, okay.
So your deep cold water actually has a lot more CO2 in it than your shallow warm water.
Interesting.
And that's one of the things that causes CO2 to mix into it. And when you get CO2 mixing into it, sometimes there's enough energy for it to dissociate a little bit and you end up with carbonic acid instead of CO2 in there, which means that's what causes ocean acidification.
Right.
So if you want to reduce the amount of carbonic acid in the oceans, you need to remove the CO2, because that will change the equilibrium state of that CO2 to carbonic acid reaction, and it'll draw it back to CO2.
Yeah.
So what you want to do is you want to actually do your carbon capture from the oceans. If you do that, then what you'll end up doing is you'll actually end up removing a lot of carbon in a more energy efficient manner, because the carbon in the oceans, hold on, I actually have this number here. Carbon is, okay. So carbon in water, all your carbon species in water is about 38 parts per million. So it's 10 times less concentrated than in air, but water is 100 times denser than air.
Gotcha. Okay.
So you actually have, you know, the equivalent of, you know, 3,800 ppm of CO2 in air in, you know, water.
Okay.
So you get this, that density really helps out with your reactions, because you can move a lot of material through faster, and you can do it at, and you kind of get the best of both worlds. You can move a lot of material through faster for less energy, because you're moving it in a more dense package, and it's a lower concentration, which means that you're not going to overload any of your reaction surfaces that you're running it through. So you can move things through very, very quickly and not worry about missing a lot.
I have not heard like anything about carbon capture and sequestration from water. Is that an accident, or is it a new thing, or it's
no, like, well, you probably actually have, you just probably didn't realize that it was carbon capture, because a lot of what people talk about in terms of pulling carbon from the ocean is to make synthetic fuels. Like the US Navy tried to do it with the US Navy did a project with it, with a nuclear powered ship, to try and pull water into it and make diesel fuel from it for the rest of their fleet. And it worked, but they just found that it wasn't very economic and their current logistics train worked better for it. So they scrapped it. But that was the whole thing. But pulling carbon from the ocean, since the ocean pulls carbon from the air, pulling carbon from the ocean is just the same as pulling carbon from the air.
Yeah. Gotcha.
So like, if
and could,
really like,
couldn't it be coupled with, like, I'm not sure what the chemical process would be, but like, if you need heat and things like that, could it be coupled with something like desalination?
Yeah.
Cause that would be interesting, like to kill two birds with one stone and create fresh water and take some carbon out. And
that is 100% a thing you could do. But there's one thing that, in my work, kind of running through these numbers, you know, just to see what's going on, is that if you have a stationary point that's pulling in water from, you know, a shoreline position,
the local
you end up having a local concentration gradient, and you end up depleting the area nearby your plant. So because you have to homogenize things if you want to keep your reaction running constantly. With air, that's really easy, because air is extremely mobile and it's constantly replenishing. But if you're pulling in water and you're releasing water without carbon, you're just going to gradually deplete the area around you of carbon, and it's going to make your plant not work.
So you need to put these in a boat or something then.
You need to put them in a boat.
And then you have the whole logistics nightmare of what, you know, concentrating the stuff in a gas. It has to be a tanker boat, I guess, to sequester what you've gotten in a gas, form a compressed gas, and then go and deliver it somewhere and inject it underground again. We're into that whole sort of maybe fantastical.
Or Or what you could do, if you have a boat with a large enough power plant, like say a nuclear ship, you could just crack the CO2 right there and you could be left with solid carbon.
It'd be a coal boat.
It would basically be a boat that makes coal on its trip. And then you just dump a big chunk of carbon onto whatever shipyard that you want. And they go bury it in a salt cavern or whatever. And then the ship goes back across the ocean. Right. So you prevent your local gradients. You remove carbon from the atmosphere. You remove acid from the ocean itself. And you're doing it with an ultra low CO2 source. This is the holy trifecta of the things that we need to do.
Interesting. I mean, it seems like there's like two, maybe there's not, I don't know. I'm not an engineer, but looking inwards, like, you know, I tend to be like a bit of a dreamer and an optimist and whatnot, but I find myself like encountering a lot of these sort of techno fixes, you know, hydrogen as a panacea or nuclear fusion or carbon capture and sequestration. And I'm like, it's cool. We can do it. It's like from an engineering perspective, like you engineers like love like, you know, going down a trail and finding a big log that's across the trail and digging under it or climbing over it or sawing it into little pieces or finding, you know, you guys thrive on problem solving, but I find that there's this, again, just as an outsider looking in, there's this kind of like myopia on solving the individual little problems, but sometimes losing track of the broader scale of like, well, is this scalable and feasible? Is that like, just from a kind of cultural anthropology of engineering, is that something that you see or think is problematic? Or
the myopia of the techno fix is very much a thing that happens, but I would say out of all of the solutions here, the pulling it from the ocean with mobile refineries for it is probably the most effective and the most efficient method we could do, and probably the most scalable, because we already have shipyards, we can make more shipyards, and we already run thousands of ships in the ocean at literally any one time. I mean, the Suez Canal was blocked for a week and there was almost 1,000 ships that had to go around Africa.
Right.
Because they just didn't have the time to wait.
I mean, this is interesting because you're thinking about these shipyards, like churning up more ships that are made out of steel, which is carbon intensive either for creating the steel itself or the blast furnaces. And, you know, maybe that can be done now with, you know, green hydrogen based like steel. But I mean, it just seems like we're kind of chasing our tail with this. And, you know, for my fairly uneducated innumerate eyes, I'm just thinking, obviously, it's better just not to put the goddamn stuff up there in the first place.
Yes. Like 100%. If you can prevent it from getting into the atmosphere, that's the best way to do it. You're a doctor. An ounce of prevention versus a pound of cure.
Oh, God. I think the ratios might be different there. You know, anyway, but yeah, I mean, and it was interesting as well. I was listening to a recent podcast that Robert Bryce did as part of his Blackout Week series on the Indian Point closure. And he had a guest on, I'll have to link it in the show notes, but he was referencing a study that was looking at the carbon abatement, like the costs of abating 1 ton of carbon. And
that was $20 for nuclear.
So $800 a ton for rooftop solar, $250 to $300 a ton for utility level photovoltaic or wind, and $20 to $25 a ton for keeping existing nuclear open.
Yeah.
Right. Which this like that statistic is just the most eye boggling. You know, in terms of looking at the hypocrisy of groups like NRDC, you know, that are dancing on the grave of Indian Point.
Oh God, right.
You know, I have to assume it's because of not just corruption, and I have to assume it's not malevolence entirely on their part, but just a real sort of blindness and misunderstanding. But it gets harder and harder to deal with that. I mean, I know that, and then we're going on a bit of a tangent here, but I think within the sort of green environmental community, they're so fixated on wind and solar being the only possible solution that they've achieved this kind of saintly status, whereby any sort of criticism of their limitations then is like, well, you're either for this or you're a climate denier and you don't care about the climate or the environment. And it's just the disconnect is really challenging.
Yeah. To kind of answer a couple of those points is that when you're talking about, because right now our entire system is based off of, you know, fossil fuels and carbon. It's anyone who says that we're not fossil fuel based right now, or, you know, will be shortly, is 100% diluting themselves.
And that's that like Vaclav Smil thing of it's, you know, obviously not just electricity, but and not just like transport fuel, but cement, steel, heat, fertilizer.
Any chemical reaction that you ever have anywhere is powered by natural gas. It's just how things are right now.
Right.
So you can talk about, you know, building ships to pull CO2 out of the atmosphere via the oceans, requiring steel and having all of these follow-on things. But the important thing to realize with any of these is that it's not a techno fix, because it's not a techno fix to say, oh, we can make a big difference with this one thing, because there's always follow-on things that happen. It's like, okay, so if we do this one thing, then we start making a big difference here. This is like the biggest difference we can make. We're going to start with the big thing. Then from there, what we can do is we can move on to, okay, where are the parts for this coming from? Can we improve that? So can we source our steel that we get for these projects from, you know, a green hydrogen blast furnace or an electrochemical smelter or something like that, something that doesn't use, you know, coal to make that. And then you're just like, okay, perfect. So those are done now. So now that we've got that, how do we do the next stage? Mm-hmm. The important thing in breaking a cycle of that is self-perpetuating is that you need to do one thing first. You just need to do something. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter what it is. You just need to do it. And that's the
Both of those things that you reference, you know, like a hydrogen blast furnace or electrochemical, I forget what the word used there.
Yeah, electrochemical smelter.
They depend on a power source, right? And if I say hydrogen's a carrier of energy, not an actual source in of itself. So that brings us back to what is the fundamental, scalable, low carbon, dispatchable. You know where I'm going with that. Yeah, but I mean,
it's as we said, the best thing to do is to stop it from getting into the atmosphere first. Yeah. Now, stopping if we did that, and no more CO2 got to the atmosphere after tomorrow, magically, somehow, no matter what, we still have 100 ppm that we need to get out of the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's no one can deny that. We need to get that out of the atmosphere because it is doing harm now.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't matter if we prevent all of the CO2 from getting into the atmosphere, because after we prevent all the CO2 from getting out of the atmosphere, or while we're preventing all the CO2 from getting into the atmosphere, we still need to pull CO2 out of the atmosphere.
Sure, sure. And that's very much Brett Kugelmass's take, is that, you know, the problem is the forcing from what's already up there.
Yeah.
There's a momentum to that. And I mean, there's a lot of obvious uncertainties in terms of the climate modeling. I think someone who's been influential for me is Mark Linus, and just in saying, you know, yes, we don't have a firm sense. You know, there's a lot of variation in terms of where the modeling takes us, but there is a non-trivial chance, you know, that we could be heading towards, you know, hothouse Earth, which would be, you know, maybe not an extinction event for humanity, but, you know, mass die-off kind of event for humanity.
Yeah,
you know, what you'd put into an insurance policy for, you know, something that has a 10% probability is probably pretty significant. So
it's a lot of zeros. It's a lot of zeros.
Yeah.
And that's the thing is that, It doesn't really matter how we decarbonize. We have to anti-carbonize. I don't know how to say it, but there are things that we need to do that are beyond just decarbonization. We're getting to the point where humanity as a species has enough energy under its control to affect the environment that we live in without even trying. Yeah. So the important thing now is to realize that since we have this amount of energy, we can't be shitty house guests anymore. We have to actually, you know, do our chores and take care of the place that we're living in. We have to apply energy towards maintaining our environment.
Right.
That is 100% the only way to do things going forward.
The only way
to not do that is to go backwards.
Yeah,
is to reduce our energy requirements to the point where we're back in 1600 and we're using donkeys and windmills to grind grain.
And like we burned on every ounce of forest around, and you know,
that's it. Yeah. There's only two ways to go. There's forward, where we start taking care and purposefully spending energy to maintain our environment, or we go back to the point where we don't control enough energy to affect our environment.
But we can't go, like, you know what I mean? Like, every step we've taken forward, every bit of technology we've applied, every advance we've made has led to, you know, a larger population, a bit more stress on the environment, and taken stress off of the environment as well, in terms of off the whales, or, you know, with the use of petroleum or with coal. Like, say, you know, forests have kind of grown back in England, for instance, or New England. But yeah, there's no way back that doesn't involve, you know, a mass die-off, which is maybe what the, you know, deep green folks actually really, really want without being upfront about it.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. There's a great book by James Lovelock, who's I think he's still alive, the centenarian. He's an independent scientist and tinkerer. He has a little laboratory in a cottage on the coast of the English coast. He invented the electron capture device, which was used to detect the accumulation of atmospheric CFCs, which led to the Montreal Protocol and saving the ozone layer. Really cool guy. That was like one of 50 incredible things he's done. But he wrote a really cool book that I liked. It was called, I think it's called A Rocky Ride to the Future. I should really have that title memorized, but he talked very much about this, that, you know, if we fail to sort of appreciate and steward some of our ecosystem support services, it's not that we're incapable of providing those services, but it's going to be a big drag on us. And he kind of compared it a little bit to, you know, having functioning kidneys versus not, and having to go to dialysis 3 times a week, build the dialysis machine, maintain it, sit there for, you know, dialysis sucks for those who aren't aware. That's, you know, 3-4 hours a day, 3 days a week. And I think what we're starting to describe in terms of, you know, carbon capture and storage, or even providing kind of wetland services, you know, if we fill all those in terms of water purification, we're creating kind of a ball and chain that I feel is going to sap a lot of humanity's energy and potential if we don't, I think, do what you're describing in terms of starting to, and I think, again, not to reference too many books, but, you know, this, I think Mark Linus wrote a book called The God Species, which, and it's building off of Stuart Brand's ideas as well. Like, you know, we are as gods, and we kind of have to start acting like ones. We are having a godlike influence on this planet. Mm-hmm. We can't be in denial of that. We need to own that and then be good ones, benevolent ones.
Yeah. Unfortunately, being a good god takes a hell of a lot of work.
Yeah. Yeah. One final question, just because I want to wrap up fairly shortly, but is the geoengineering using iron seeding of the oceans, is that a carbon capture technique, or is that something else?
It is, because the purpose of that is to promote the growth of what are called diatoms. Diatoms are microscopic organizations that do most of the CO2 management and oxygen management of our oceans. Like, they exist in hundreds. You can't count them in numbers. You basically have to count them in hundreds of millions of tons, because that's how much they are. And they fluctuate by tens of millions of tons a day, because they live for very short times, but they multiply like absolute madmen.
Okay.
Like, you can, if you can get a time lapse, you can probably find a time lapse online of like a diatom bloom in the Pacific Ocean. And it's this 1,000 kilometer long, like, set of green tendrils that just explodes into the ocean and then disappears.
Wow. Okay.
And that's the idea there, is that the iron seeding would kind of take up a bunch of molecules that prevent diatom division and formation, because diatoms are very sensitive chemically, because what they do is they create limestone, basically. They build their bodies out of calcium carbonate, and they need CO2 to do that, but they need a very specific chemical composition of the water surrounding them to allow that reaction to happen. And the iron removes some of the materials that prevent that reaction from happening. So
gotcha.
You get these giant blooms that happen with the iron seeding, which pulls out hundreds of millions of tons of carbon dioxide in like weeks or months. Like,
and then the diatoms die and fall to the bottom of the ocean and turn into limestone?
Yeah, they die off, they fall to the bottom, and they just sit there forever.
So this sounds kind of too good to be true. So what's going on there? I think there was an experiment actually off the west coast of Canada, no?
There have been many, many attempts to try iron seeding. They tend to get stopped by concerned environmental groups.
Right.
And honestly, I'm kind of with the environmental groups on this, because one of the problems with iron seeding is that it's a very kind of watchmaker style experiment. You build it from the beginning, you put all the parts together, and then you let it go. And it either works or it doesn't. And if it doesn't work, you can have some serious chemical complications in the local environment.
Like what exactly?
You get red algae blooms.
Yeah.
Red algae blooms, super bad.
Right. is this an area, like, I know there's a lot of criticism of, you know, by environmentalists and others of even just research into geoengineering, because they're, you know, it's just too terrible to contemplate. I mean, I think it sounds awful, like the sulfur spraying and the sky turning into like a milky yellowy white color, and like, never, you know, looking at my son and being like, the sky used to be blue, son. It's blue. Horrifying to, but I mean, I support research into it, because honestly, I mean, again, when you start to look at the scale of the issues that we're up against, and, you know, just this conversation so far has not, it's been very interesting, but it's not made me go, oh yeah, carbon capture, we got this, you know? So from the perspective of iron seeding, like, is it an issue where we need to allow more research so that we can understand it better and dial in exactly?
I would think we would very much need to do more research on it and really get it in. But the thing is that you can do that research. You can find isolated places, or if you really want to, you can just make a giant tank, pump in a bunch of ocean water, and run your small scale tests. Like, you can do that, and we really should. Because as much as I kind of agree that geoengineering is a really, really big hammer for any problem, we might need a really big hammer for
a big
problem.
We got a big nail,
because that's the thing, is that, well, technically, carbon capture and storage is just geoengineering on a more controllable basis, because you constantly have power input and you can control the amount that you're doing at any one time. It is at the scale that we would have to do carbon capture, that's a geoengineering project. There's no other way of really saying anything other than that. It is a geoengineering project, because it is directly and purposefully influencing our environment for our and everything else that lives on the planet's benefit.
Genghis Khan was a geoengineer.
Basically, yeah. Just that's a crazy. a very uncontrolled geoengineer. But And so that's the thing, is that we do have to, like, we really should figure out how to do geoengineering in a way that works. The problem is that, you know, we only have one lab to do it in, and it's the place that we all live. So people are very hesitant about it.
Yeah. Well, so, this has been a fascinating conversation, Sean. And I don't know. I don't think we just had that insight, but carbon capture and sequestration is geoengineering. That's a I mean, so many things are that we don't think of, right? But, you know, killing off the megafauna was geoengineering.
Our entire electricity grid is geoengineering.
Just explain that quickly. Just because we're putting CO2 in the air.
Because we're putting CO2 into the
atmosphere. Yeah, got you.
And we're making excess heat that wouldn't have gone into there anyway. Like,
when
you apply energy to a system on that scale, like, that's geoengineering.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if it's not on purpose, it's still geoengineering.
Wow. Okay, Sean, this has been a blast. You have been invaluable in previous episodes in terms of giving me some background information, and I gotta credit that, and especially in the hydrogen conversation. But it's great having you on, and it's awesome having you.
It's fun to be on. I hope I can be on again for some other topics.
Yeah, I think the listeners are gonna love this. So thanks again, Sean. We'll touch bases again soon when we come across a similarly nerdy technical topic.
Anytime, my friend.
All right, bye for now. If you enjoyed the podcast, please make sure to subscribe, like, and review us on your podcast platform of choice. Until next time, guys.